can imagine the voltage that you'd build up across the gap there where the variable condenser is located. So they do have, you know, transmitting loops, and of course you have to have a sufficiently high voltage tuning capacitor to handle the peak voltages that you will count, you know, get at the turbine place where the loop terminates. So anyway, it's not a complicated thing. I mean, it's not, you know, a big, you know, immense project or anything. It's basically more of a woodworking job than there is electronics, because you're just putting a piece of cable around the outside of these frames and putting a simple variable condenser in the middle of, you know, at the terminating point and hooking your receiver coax to it. And you're going to see something, you would actually say to yourself, my mouth fell open the first time, really, when I saw the effect fall over.
Cincinnati, W2EWK.
K2RIW back, stand by 1 second. EWK, and yeah, Mal, you'll have to explain one day. We'll turn it over to him, because I'd like to, you disconnect, you have to temporarily disconnect your antenna when you transmit. Not like the old days when, you know, everybody worked split, and when you transmit, you have to avoid taking out your receiver, so I'm sure you got that's probably why you got the relays and everything close up, I would think, no. Another station in there, no. But let's see if Dick is back first. K2RIWWS2N.
Yeah, it's time for you guys to start looking at your email. It should be arriving pretty soon, and I think you're going to like it. Eugene, go ahead.
Okay, QSL. Mel, I had two radios side by side, okay? And I had an antenna switch, you know? And somehow, don't ask me how, I got backwards. So what happened is that I transmit from one radio into another radio with 100 watts. And I blew out my ICOM IC7000. I had to send that back to the factory to get fixed. And they fixed it, and they sent it back to me within 2 weeks. QSL?
Oh, well, that's a precaution you got to take, Eric. And we can't possibly do that, and that's why I have the switching arrangement that I do have. Basically, because the old system I have of a separate receiver transmitter, you had an antenna relay and changeover relay, which was popular many years. A company called Dalkey was the big one in amateur radio switching relays, which was actually made. That was what it was. It was a relay with that had coax connectors on it. So I'm basically using, except Collins, I'm using Collins had a fancier version of it. And I use that, and I got a couple of them, but the way they're hooked up is so that there's no way that the 1500 watt Collins transmitter is ever going to get into either my receiving loop inside the house or into the other receiver. That, as a precaution, would be a major disaster. So it's a situation that, yes, you just have to take some precautions. Very good thing. You know, I also, before with the night sound, Dick, I have a couple of emails here I wanted to answer. One about we started last week, but we didn't get too deep into it. I promised to give a little bit more of a detail on wave angles, Dick. So maybe we'll leave a few minutes for that before we close down. Over.
Okay. You guys start looking at your email. Frank, Paul, and Mel, who's going to start receiving it first?
Not near the computer, that's the problem. Okay, so I'll have to take a look at it when we're finished. All right, anyhow, we had a discussion, you know, people, a couple of females I had about what is this, all the jazz with the waves, the angles and things that they talk about on the air, so I thought maybe we could say a few words. We started, you know, to say a few words last week, but there's some confusion. It seems like, on one hand, questioned the Billy New Hammond, and he asked me a couple of questions. I said, well, listen, I will basically give this a little bit of a discussion of what actually, you know, it would pertain to. discussing, you know, how a signal arrives at different angles. So, Dick, you want to continue, and then I'll pick that up in a little while, though, before we close down. Over.
I got your email, Dick.
Okay, have you seen the first picture yet?
I'm glancing through it. I went right down to the bottom. I can't believe the sun with the Betelgeuse, but yeah, I'm looking at it there.
Ain't that amazing, those sizes? This is a bit of a mind blower, Mel. I think you ought to take a couple of minutes and walk over to your computer.
I'll pick it up in a little while, Dick. I don't want to, break up the tech net right now. So we'll be closing down pretty soon anyhow, because we'll, be running out of time on the tech net. So I thought maybe that we could pick up one or two more things and then have some time if there's anything left to continue over.
Okay, now, in the case of wave angle, the way I was approaching it last week is the takeoff wave angle, elevation angle, when you know the antenna is, say, horizontally polarized and a known number of wavelengths off the ground. And it really is a phased array of the real antenna above the ground plus the mirror image of the antenna below the ground. At a certain angle, those signals come together back in phase. I don't have the mathematics of that one in front of me, but it's in the AR realm antenna book. I'm reasonably sure it's in the antenna section of the ARRL Radio Amateurs Handbook for Radio Amateurs, and quite a few different places. So is that the wave angle we're speaking about now? Should we speak about that some more, or do you want to go on to the next email? Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I think that what the confusion really is, basically what you are talking about, sometimes you hear them discussing it on the air, and people will say, vertical angle of radiation, wave angle, takeoff angle, they all mean the same thing. So whatever one would ask me about takeoff angle. Takeoff angle is the same thing as a wave angle. And vertical angle of radiation is the same thing. They're all meaning the same thing. Now, what it came by, many years ago, the communications for, say, United States here, the East Coast to Europe, was taken in by a number of these commercial stations. In fact, there was one out in Long Island, I believe they called themselves the K Radio. And they would transmit messages to Europe. This is before satellites took over. And there was only two ways, of course, to get your messages back and forth from Europe. One was by the Atlantic cable, and the other one by radio communications. So they did a lot of experimenting, and they found that the optimum wave angle range is 40 HF frequencies. And they have a chart on that. Now let's take just one question about, so we'll just discuss that one. Let's say 40 meters. They found that 40 meters, that the best angle for 40 meters would be between 10 and 35 degrees. So if you're saying to yourself, what does that mean to me? So, okay, there is a formula that Dick just mentioned. And the formula basically says that the wave angle is the wavelength divided by 4 times the height in meters of your antenna. So if you wanted it as an example, you mentioned 40 meters. 40 meters, let's say your antenna is 40 meters would be wavelength divided by 4, so you would have wavelength over the frequency, first of all, to determine the meters of 40 meters. So it would be like 300,000 times 10 to the 6th power divided by 7.000 megahertz, which would do in meters, 42.57 meters. That would be the exact of 40 meters. Now, we call it 40, but it's...
Now your mic is... your bus?
Went through the bus, didn't need it. So we, let me get back to it. So if you took this 42.857 and you divided it by 4, you get 10714 times. Now if your height in feet of your antenna, let's say, was 100 feet up, it would be times 0.3048 to get it into meters. So you wind up with 10714 times 30.48, which would equal 32.66 degrees. Now, that would fall, so if you look at the chart, and they tell you that it's between 10 and 35 degrees approximately would be optimum for working DX on 40 meters. Now, if your antenna was, say, at anywhere between, you know, in other words, it's not going to say that if your antenna is not 100 feet up, that's not going to work. But it gives you an idea what they mean by the antenna height versus wave angle. There's a number of charts that you can look at, but if you use that formula, in other words, for your antenna, it'll give you a ballpark idea, and then look up the charts of what's optimum and see if you fall in between there. That'll give you an idea as to what the wave angle of your particular station's antenna is actually working at. I think that's about the simplest way I can put it, Dick, over.
I believe I agree. The formula itself, I don't have it in front of me. I've seen yours, I've seen the way it works, and it seems reasonable. What will make it also a little bit more clear is to find the right set of diagrams in probably the ARRL antenna book, where they will show you a particular antenna, like a dipole, loop, cubical quad, whatever, but they'll show you various altitudes off the ground, what the plotted elevation pattern will look like. You combine that with this formula, and it all makes some sense as to the so-called takeoff angle is not a real sharp thing. That's where the peak of the beam of the elevation lobe is. And if you go to the right set of diagrams in the right book, you can see it as a three-dimensional antenna pattern. And that makes it even a little bit more clear than just a two-dimensional, a slice of the pattern, so to speak. And three-dimensionally, it'll show you what's going on, and if you tune it for, say, 32 degrees, like in Mel's example, that's the peak of the beam, and you probably could go anywhere from 20 degrees to 40 degrees, and you still have a reasonable amount of power being delivered at that elevation angle to the ionosphere. So it's not a real sharp thing until you get to VHF frequencies where the antenna is a whole lot of wavelengths off the ground. Then the lobe itself becomes a very sharp lobe, and there's a whole lot of them. There's really a whole fan beam out there of elevation lobes. I mean, you're up at a reasonable altitude at the upper VHF and UHF frequencies. HF, because the wavelengths are so darn big, I mean, 80 meters is what, 240 feet, roughly, 250 feet is a wavelength. So unless you've got a lot of resources, not many of us are going to get that antenna 5 wavelengths off the ground, you know, 100, 1,000, 1,250 feet. Not very many of us are going to mount an antenna that high. We could dream about that, but I doubt it. Although, to drag a wire behind an airplane and light it up on 80 meters, that would be a lot of fun. K2KUI.
H-U-R-I-W. W-S-2-N, comment about the email.
Go ahead, Paul.
I particularly like the one where they show Cirrus versus the sun, and then next to that they have Pollux, which is much larger, and then Arcturus. But like Cirrus, they show like, oh, 1 inch in diameter, it comes out on my screen about. And then they show the sun, maybe a little less than a quarter of an inch. And they show Jupiter, one pixel. So that's pretty amazing. And I'm looking at the Earth versus the Jupiter, and I always read it was about 318 Earths you could fit inside. I would guess so. You know, if you, I'm trying to put the numbers together. And that looks like about the same relationship with Jupiter to the Sun. So, you know, you can imagine how many Earths could get inside the Sun. So very good, Dick. I'm definitely going to save this. Thank you. Back to you.
Now, I have made on a inkjet printer a series of copies of these. Almost everybody I show that to says, wow, I got to have that. You got to give that to me. So I keep making more and more copies. I'm burning up a whole lot of inkjet cartridges, making copies of this damn thing. Because everybody I show it to at first doesn't believe it, and then they say, wow. What's really going on here, Mel, is that, remember when I told you when opportunity is miles away? That's a big number. And the sun is 93 million miles or 92 million miles from us. Those numbers, you can say them, you can memorize them, you can write them down, they have some meaning. When you see it as a physical diagram, it's a mind blower. When I make that scale model of Earth being a 50-cent piece and dime being Mars, 2-to-1 ratio in size, and when you make the distance between them also a scale model, you have to put the dime a half a mile away from the 50-cent piece. So that therefore, what NASA did was to take off on the 50-cent piece and land on the dime half a mile away and land on the right letter that's imprinted on that dime. The right section of the letter on that dime half a mile away. That's an extremely good navigation trick. Well, by the same token, you look at the size of Earth, Venus, Mars, Pluto, Uranus. Saturn, Neptune. You look at those, they have reasonable size relationship. You look at them compared to Jupiter and Saturn, you're amazed. You look at all of those planets compared to the Sun, and the size differences are such that you just barely can't even see the Earth and Pluto alongside of the Sun. The Sun to us is a darn big star, but it's just a medium-sized star. You see that alongside of Sirius. The biggest star that we see is Sirius. You see the Sun alongside of Sirius, and the Sun is a tiny little thing. But Sirius looks very big to us because star-wise, it's very close. But then you look at the really big stars, and they make Sirius look ultra-miniature. The real sizes of things, when you see them on a comparison chart, I mean, this chart shows you the sizes, the diameters of these things, and the approximate color of them, but it doesn't show you the scale distance between them. That would just not fit on the paper if the paper is a zillion miles long. But just seeing their diameters is a bit of a mind blow. Or when people say that things in the universe are big, wow. Okay, who else has seen it? I wonder if you've seen it already, Frank.
Dick, I got a comment for your W2WK.
Oh, I don't know. And Dick, WS2M. Dick?
Frank, you were about 10% copy. You're going to have to aim your antenna a little bit different, increase your power. You're going to do something. You want to make another attempt, or you have to wait until the propagation gets better. You were only in there 10% of the time that time, Frank. I think you said you did receive it. Is that true?
Yes, I received it. And I said you were able to
noisy signal, but I think you said you did receive it and you sent me your response. Now I'm going to go look at your response. Okay, Eugene, you wanted to say something and then Paul in that order. Go ahead, Eugene.
Okay, Dick, I agree with you, but that dipole, how high is it supposed to be? I say a little bit over 1,000 feet. Okay, I have a solution for you. Okay, we can do it. Not by an airplane, not. But I have a perfect solution. air balloon. We can put a repeat up there on that band. And we can run a few watts up there, and that can be the repeater, QSL. Then we can get out. Is that a very good idea?
Without a doubt. Some of the smart guys on Long Island, particularly the QRP people, who love operating at a beachfront on 160 meters, will string 300-some-odd feet of wire up in the air with a helium-filled balloon. As long as it's not too windy a day where the wire gets blown parallel to the ground, that can work very well. You also got to be a little bit careful about putting a discharge resistor somewhere because you built up a lightning charge on the wire. But a number of hems, K2YEW has on occasion used a helium-filled balloon to string his 160-meter vertical ground plane wire antenna up in the air and feed it with QRP transmitters. He's done that on a number of occasions. Hot air balloon is one way. Helium-filled balloon can lift a little bit more. And so that would be fun. A radio-controlled model airplane with another one. Yes, some of these guys also with satellites will practice with a satellite by putting it up on a tethered helium-filled balloon. And that's a lot of fun. Paul, WS2N.
In fact, don't forget, you can even do it with a kite.
I agree with you. Another good idea. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, Dick. If you're ever walking around the libraries, you might have seen this picture before. They have it usually on a wall, and it's a picture of the universe. I had gotten this from our library. They were getting rid of books, yeah, and you know, sometimes they give you, there'll be a whole stack of books, 5 cents each, 10 cents each. I've gotten books like astronomy dictionaries and things like that for 5 cents. You know, there's a map that they had a 5 cent tag on. Here, take it. And it's incredible. I wish you could get this thing onto a computer. Maybe if I can take a picture and then digitally put it in, that would be good. It's got a picture of, you know, our solar system, and then a line being drawn over to another area on this huge map, and it points to one little location, and they showed a local group, some 20-odd stars. They call that local group. That local group they show going to one of the arms on the Milky Way, and another little box, and that the box of the Milky Way goes over to another little location where maybe the size of a pea, the whole Milky Way, and it's roughly a 10 by 10 area, you know, with other galaxies. Now that group goes to another location, except it's bigger, maybe about 20 by 10, and again it shows this whole other group, you know, all these other galaxies, the size of a pea. Again, it goes on and on like this, and then that whole section goes into another section, which would be one little dot or a pixel of the whole universe. So you should, if you ever get a chance to check that out, Dick, if you haven't seen it already, that's pretty amazing. That's what this picture that you sent reminds me of. But this is good. This is more local. So this is, I think, more astonishing. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, the picture you described is one of the displays that's used at the Rose Center Hayden Planetarium when you go to their recent show. I've also seen it as a picture called Powers of Ten sent by Scientific American. And there's a somewhat similar picture in the early chapter of John Krause's book called Radio Astronomy. So those Powers of Ten, where you keep zooming in or zooming out, gives you a feel for how big things really are. And if you really want to do a lot of zooming, you can start off with something at the micro, at the nanotechnology size, in other words, down at the, a proton or a neutron, back away and you see the whole nucleus of a molecule, back away and you see the orbits of the electrons around it, back away and you see how that molecule is part of a lattice, a crystal lattice, if, say, for instance, it's one molecule of a crystal, back away and you see the whole lump of material that the crystal is made out of. You back away enough and you see the ocean is buried in, or the peninsula it's on. Eventually you see the continent, you see the Earth, you see the nearby planet, and so on. It's kind of a magic, it's kind of amazing how you've got circles inside of circles, and it goes on for a ridiculous number of orders of magnitude. Another one that blows my mind, and there's no good way to show a picture, but imagine the fact that the sun right now is putting out a tremendous amount of power. Here we are 93 million miles away, and at our distance, we're receiving 1,300 watts per square meter. You work that backwards toward the diameter of the sun, and you can figure out, for the right at the sun's surface, you can figure out the total energy the sun is putting out. And I think it comes out to be 10 to the 26 watts. Really big number. The sun is going to put out that amount of power for roughly 10 billion years. It turns out to be a total of, I think it's 10 to the 46 joules of energy is going to come out of the sun over a 10 billion year period. So 10 to the 10 years, 10 to the 46 joules of energy. That's the sun. And when something goes on in space called a gamma ray burst, the gamma ray burst puts out that amount of energy that the sun puts out in 10 billion years, that amount of energy is emitted in roughly 1 second. My goodness, is that a lot of power in a hurry. If that occurs within 26 light years of where you are, you're gone. Game over, cooked, fried, dead, buried, vaporized, gone. Game over. Thank you, Mel. KTKEY, KTYW.
Yeah, very good. This is KTKEY, and I guess we're lucky that we have Jupiter in our solar system acting as a big, collector, garbage collector of everything that's flying around. It seems like it's like a magnet that pulls it all in. Otherwise, I guess we would have been a goner a long time ago. All right. Anyhow, one final word on wave angles. As Dick said, that once you notice it, you go to the ARRL manual, and once you know the wave angle of your particular antennae, it's the mass again. I think I better repeat the formula. Wave angle is equal to the wavelength of the particular frequency divided by 4 times height of your antenna, and that will be, of course, you'll most likely have your height of your antenna in feet, and you convert it over to meters, which makes it times 0.3048. You do that math. Now, once you got the wave angle, go to the chart, and it'll show you that you'll see the lobes, first, second, third, fourth, and fifth lobes, and you'll see where your particular antenna for that frequency and all falls into. So that way you can get an idea how many lobes it requires or to work the DX station. But like I say, it's just a theoretical situation, and it's not to be taken completely by gospel. But you don't fall into that into those angles that they suggest. That doesn't mean that you're not going to make contact. So don't worry about it. And that's it. Let's see. As far as I can say, Jupiter. I guess without Jupiter, I can imagine what would have happened to the Earth a long time ago. Take over.
By the way, Frank, K2MLB, I got your email message where he said sometimes pictures make more vivid comparison than numbers. Thanks, Dick, from Frank. So we got that. Do you have any other emails that we should be answering, Mel? I guess is the next question. Are we almost caught up? Thank you, Mel.
And that's about it. The rest is more or less, more or less referred them back to past tutelages that they had some questions about, some steps on it. So I guess that's basically what it is. Yeah, I've got quite a number. Again, I'm going to tell you, a heck of a lot of them are questioning me. They're sending me brochures on people with, in the electronics, with electronic types of pieces of equipment, that whether or not they should invest in these companies. You know, I'm not going to leave you with, I don't know nothing about investments. That, I'm not that clever when it comes to advising people. I'm not a broker or whatever that can advise you about investing into a stock, whether it's going to take off if this item has very much merit or whatever. So I've gotten a number of those questions about things of that sort, also about how to do estimates on certain types of, the valuation. No, this is not in the realm of ham radio. You must keep it in the realm of ham radio. Again, I overemphasize that too many of them are sort of getting off, amateur radio, getting into more of a commercial questions, Dick. So, I guess I've been averaging between 65 and about 80 emails a week, Dick, associated with amateur radio, but I could say these are ones that are getting off the amateur radio and getting into things like investments. So I'm just not going to bother with those, Dick.
Frank, are you saying something to us? Sorry to say, Frank, you're not breaking through. The propagation to Orange, New Jersey really changes from time to time. When I was publishing articles in QST Magazine, I would get a couple of hundred letters a year, and some of them were very difficult to handle. Some of them, the people would be asking me, what's the best transmitter to buy, and give you a great big list of transmitters. I can't really answer that one. The most difficult one to even think about is where somebody lists every single piece of radio equipment and test equipment they own and ask you, how can I make the best use of all this stuff? That's just much too vague a question. The most heart-rendering one I've told you before is that there's a poor guy who was living in Mexico and wanted me to help him build a satellite ground station. Back in the days before you could buy TVROs, that was when I had that 12-foot dish article in 1972 QST Magazine, the August issue, and he wanted to supply American television to his American wife, who was living with him in Mexico. She told him she would stay with him if he could supply her American television by satellite. So he sent me this check drawn on a Mexican bank to kick the project off, where I was supposed to help him build the low noise amplifier, the mixer, the down converter, the dish, the feed horn, the tracking system. My goodness. There's just no way I could live his life for him, so to speak. And so there was another guy who would send me question after question every couple of days in writing. Two sheets of paper with 5 or 10 questions on each side, 4 sides altogether. And by the time the 14th letter arrived over about a 1 or 1.5 month period, I had to stop. I just couldn't live his life for him. So we got to be careful. I mean, just because you and I are on the air and people think that, gee, I like listening to those guys, they seem to have the answers, so therefore I'm going to ask them my question. There's a limit. You guys have to realize Mel and I have got only a certain number of hours per day. We got to keep our boss happy, the wife happy, the landlord happy, the tax collector happy, and so on. And we've got lives to live, so also. We're doing this as a hobby. And so my promise is that I will try my best to answer any question that people ask me on the air. And on some occasions, I'll answer telephone questions on the telephone. I cannot volunteer to answer questions by email. I'm much too slow a typer. I spent this whole last weekend typing up a 7-page, well-documented letter to the people in a particular town on Long Island that's having a lot of problems with this situation with the Department of Homeland Security wanting to put emergency communication antennas on the water towers and on the radio towers in their town.
Yeah, I got to tell you this one. I was upstate New York on a short mountain. It's only a very close, very long mountain. It's called Mount Joe. You might know it. It's about 1,800 feet or something. And it looks down on something called Heart Lake, which is a campground around Heart Lake. I'm up on top of this thing. I stayed there overnight. And in the evening, when the sun went down, I don't know what possessed me, but I took my light, I aimed it at Heart Lake, and I sent it to CQ. And before long, I got an answer. It turned out that it was a couple of Boy Scouts, you know, young kids, and they were very excited when they saw the CQ. They got all, you know, they started answering me, and we were chatting with quite a while, and I told them, you know, the next morning I'm going to come down the mountain, and I will see you guys, and all of that stuff. And we did that. So it pays to have a light with you.
Yeah, roger, roger. I can say you never know. You never know what the situation is. You know, everybody used to make fun of me. He knows, oh, he's got something in his pocket, tools, the light. We were with another couple, oh, this is some years ago, and we're riding along on the parkway. It's in this guy's car. We're riding along, and all of a sudden, everything, the engine stops. Just stops dead. And I said, coast over. I said, oh, he's trying to dart it. Nothing's working. And right away I surmised that something happened with the electrical system because, you know, he tried to put it in neutral, try to turn it side so the lights, everything go out, everything. So I said, I said something, you know, electrical. And sure enough, he coasted over, opened up the hood, and I could see the battery terminals were really crummy looking. So I have my little flashlight, I reached in, I got my Leatherman out with the pliers and all, I tightened the terminals up a little bit quicker than the thing, 1, 2, 3, I said, give it a try, and started right up. Oh my God, the hero of the day and everything like that. I said to myself, you always make fun of me, huh, with the carrying these tools, this thing with me in my life and all that. I was always equipped to do something, but I'll tell you, it has come in handy more than once, Barry, over.
Yeah, I got to tell you what, this is one of these completely unappreciated moments, and I, to this day, think it was absolutely unbelievable, but the guy I was with just didn't get it, and it's a shame, because it was really a momentous moment. We're sitting here, and I'm not kidding, I'm in the middle of darkest Africa, southern Nigeria, near Port Harcourt. We get off a boat on a river, you know, and we get into this little, it's a military outpost. And this is the transmitter that they're using that I didn't sell him, some other guy sold him, but he asked me to go down and look at it. So anyway, I'm down there and I'm looking at his transmitter, and you know, I turned it on and I'm listening, and it's got this raucous hum. That's why it's not working. And you know, something goes off my head. This thing needs a filter condenser, I'm sure. So I take it apart, you know, and I sure enough, I see some filter condensers in there, but I have no tools with me. I've got a screwdriver. Nothing. Well, it turned out when I was in New York, before I left for Africa, for reasons I can't imagine, I stuck a 40-450 filter condenser in my pocket. I guess I forgot to take it out of my pocket. And there I am in Africa, I reach into my pocket, and I see this 40-450 cap. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. I put this across the capacitor in the, you know, in the transmitter, starts to work right away. You know, I don't know if it was exactly right, but 40 and 450 certainly made this thing happy. And then the hum stopped, you know, and all of a sudden the volts came on. The thing was working. I didn't even have a soldering iron. I just twisted everything together and put it together. And the guy that was with me, I showed him this and said, you can't imagine how incredible this is. And he's looking at me and saying, what's the big deal, you know?
Tell you something. I was going on a trip, and I was packing things. I think that would be down at the end of the list if I ever even thought of it. Putting a 450, a 40 mic 450 capacitor in my pocket. First of all, were you going there to do service? What were you going to Africa for? A safari or something? Or exactly, what the heck were you doing there, over?
I was, at that particular time, I was there at the request of another person who was selling, he wanted to sell radios, communications radios, to the Nigerian military. And I knew a lot about radio. Saw Al Katz down in New Jersey. It's actually his uncle was the guy. And this guy, he knew nothing about radio. But Al, of course, knew me and suggested that I should go with this guy to Africa. So he paid me for the trip. It turned out that he never sold him a radio. I did later on, but that's a long story. That's a very long story. But anyway, I was down there because this guy was trying to sell radios, and he asked me as a favor if I would go down to southern Nigeria for him and look at this radio. He just wanted to make the military happy, you know. So he sent his man down there, kind of like that sort of thing, you know. But I was pretty much the technical advisor for the guy. I was trying to determine for him what type of radios they needed. And it turned out in the end, we wound up building them at Tentec. I wound up designing them. It's something called a military man pack that we made, but that's another whole story for another whole night. Over.
I'm trying to get at what made you, prompted you to say, I'm going to put a filter condenser in my pocket. How come not, I don't know, a resistor or a pilot light, anything. What made you put a filter capacitor in your pocket, Barry? I can't get this through my head, over.
I can't get it through mine. But what happened was, at the time, I was still doing TV repair. So what happened was, a few days before I left, the day before I left, whatever, I was working on somebody's TV set, and instead of putting the filter capacitor back in my toolbox, I stuck it in my pocket. Just doing its job. I guess I didn't need the capacitor. It wasn't what was wrong with this guy's TV set. So I stuck it in my pocket. The very next day, I find myself on a plane to Africa. I just never took it out of my pocket. That's why I thought it was so incredible.
Sure was. That was really one in a zillion. That's as astronomical odds that you have to have the right value filter with you. Well, today, boy, God forbid if you ever get caught with a filter capacitor, they would think you have a stick of dynamite that this was. You'd never get on the airplane with it today, Barry, over.
Mel, I can tell you a funny story about that. I was in, where was I now? Let me think. Holland. We were going through the Schiphol Airport in Holland. Gotta have, watch out how I pronounce that place, right? And they x-rayed my baggage. Now, I had a prototype of a man-pack radio on me, and I put it on the table. This was a metal case, you know. It had a whole bunch of batteries in it. You know, it was a prototype, so it wasn't too pretty, you know. And I stuck this thing on the table. It went through the x-ray thing, and I looked up at the x-ray machine when it went by. And you could see the batteries in there. I mean, it's all connected together. And I looked at the guy who was taking the x-ray, and he looked at me. He said, okay, no problem. And to me, that looked like a bomb. What can I tell you?
That sure would. Gee, that's amazing. They let it go through. Well, maybe over there they must be a little bit more lax, you know, over there than they are here. But I don't think you'd get through it here that with something like that. I'm